Professor Roulet.
Traffic congestion up here. Okay, so you will notice something different from the previous two speakers. I'm not going to use PowerPoint, and this is deliberate. In fact, in many situations, and I would say in environmental science, particularly relating to policy and politics, one might use the term lack of power for PowerPoint presentations as opposed to a PowerPoint presentation. There's two reasons for this. One is that what happens is that the audience does not focus on the exchange between the speaker and the individuals. Now, you have to imagine yourself, the context I'm going to speak on is my personal experiences with dealing in the policy development field and, in fact, dealing directly with political decision makers over certain environmental issues. And my experience there is that you want to make as much contact with those individuals on a personal exchange level, because then they can't squirm out of actually having to face the tough decisions that they have to make. The second thing is that as soon as you put something up on PowerPoint, you can very easily distract the entire audience from the central questions, and they get hung up on some little piece of data and start debating that particular point. What is the uncertainty levels around this dot that you have on your diagram and these types of things, which is totally irrelevant to the discussion that you're having at hand. So I deliberately use Tony's instructions of having a PowerPoint presentation as a hook to turn around the other way and say, no, don't, because what's the discussion we're having here at hand? The second thing is that I recommend, because of the discussion that we're having here, that everybody in the room, if you have not read them already, read two books in particular. The first one is by Roger Pelkey Jr., and it's called The Honest Broker. And it's Making Sense of Science in Policy and Politics, and it's published by Cambridge University, came out in 2007. Roger Pelkey was originally trained as an atmospheric scientist until he finished his master's, and then did his PhD at Colorado in science and policy. And one of the things that his PhD is very famous because what he did is he examined the issue of extreme weather in the United States. And much to many people's surprise, he actually found out that meteorologically, during the period of time he did his research, there was absolutely no increase, demonstrated statistical increase in extreme weather. What there was is that there was a huge increase in the damages caused by extreme weather. Why was that the case? It was the case because the largest growth in the United States happened in Florida. The largest growth in income had happened in Florida, and this is where the extreme weather was happening. And it was the advent of air conditioning that actually allowed people to move into these areas and made them habitable, and we had put ourselves in harm's way. And so he really deals with these issues. He's now at NCAR. He's back at Colorado, but he was at NCAR for a period of time in the society and climate section. The second book, which gets right to some of the issues that both Norm and Dave were talking about, that is a very important book for people to read. You may not agree with the arguments, but it is raised, is Mike Hume's book on, and I cannot remember whether this is Why is We Disagree About Climate Change or Why We Can't Agree About Climate Change. I can't remember exactly what the title is. Why We Can't Agree About Climate Change. Again, I think it's published by Cambridge University Press. And it goes through many of the issues that Norm raised where we look at problems. Scientists tend to look at things in only a very narrow analytical sort of way. And unless you read something like this and realize the audience that you're dealing with and the policymakers and the decision makers that you are trying to inform, as we do as ordinary citizens outside our fields that we're experts in, come with a whole range of perceptions about a particular problem to deal with or how we're going to deal with those problems. So what I want to do is I want to talk about a few little stories that I want to tell you about that really opened my eyes to some of the issues that I think are really important. I had anticipated what both Norm and Dave were going to talk about, so I'm not going to duplicate those types of things. So, what's this?
Well, it's so predictable. Some certainty, anyway.
Well, I'm a modeler, right? So I just modeled. I modeled them last week and determined what their outcome would be, and I was bang on, so... I have my error bars, though, so anyways. So I've got kind of five or six stories to go through. It depends on what time we have here. Just whack me, Tony, when we get to the right point. Okay. So my first point is that the last thing that people want to hear when you're in a policy environment, in your policy environment, or you're trying to direct politicians, is a bunch of scientific facts that they cannot put in a context or contextualize. My very first foray into dealing directly in policy and politics was a set of hearings that were in Ottawa, which had almost all the ADMs and some of the deputy ministers in the major departments. This was when the Liberals were in power. It was about 15 years ago, talking about climate change. I was invited because at that point in time, I was on the second assessment report at that point in time. Anybody that goes through three of them and needs their head read, I think. But anyways. And so we were there. There were five of us at the front of the room, and we were gave little presentations. And I was particularly asked to give a presentation on the global carbon cycle, Canada's role in the global carbon cycle. And this issue at the time, which was a particularly hot issue, was about the missing CO2. What it was is that the global carbon cycle exchanges about 150 petagrams of carbon a year. Now, you stand up in a group of politicians or policy wonks and you say petagrams, and they look at you and their eyes roll back in their head. So if you stood on the Champlain Bridge for half a year, look at the St. Lawrence River flowing underneath you, that's a petagram, okay? So there's 150 of those flowing underneath you of carbon that goes back and forth between the surface of the Earth and the atmosphere. Humans only put in 8 petagrams. The reason it's a problem is that we take those petagrams from geologic deposits that have turnover times of hundreds of millions of years and stick it into the atmosphere, which is turning over on 100 to 150 years, and that's what the central problem is. In that discussion and at that time in science, there were 2 petagrams that we could not solve. We couldn't find these 2 petagrams out of the 150 petagrams. Now, you put 2 over 150, and you can figure out that it's less than 1%. Some young economist, I assume this, he was from the Department of Finance, stood up and began to lecture me and said, you expect us to develop a whole policy, taxation and all these types of things. I didn't say any of these things about taxation. He said, to be able to regulate CO2 when you can't even solve the CO2 budget. I was kind of sitting there. A senior colleague of mine that was sitting beside me, it happened to be Lawrence Mizak from this university, poked me and said, ask him about the budget. Ask him about the federal budget. And I then realized what Lawrence was doing was saying, get this on the context of something that they understand in this room. So then I turned around to the guy and I said, okay, so just hold on for a minute. What are your cost estimates for the next year, fiscal year? He looked at me and I said, well, why? I said, well, just what are those? So he said, oh, we got all this analysis we do. You know, we got a department of 8,000 people that do this kind of analysis, and this is the number we come up with. I said, okay, what was the estimate for last year? He gave me the estimate. I said, and what did you actually spend? Well, they were out by 6%. So I did this analysis and did the ratio on the thing, and we were actually 6 times better than they were. And immediately that completely diffused the discussion, and this whole notion, which was uncertainty that was the central focus of the discussion, completely evaporated. And so getting it into context of something that people can understand is absolutely critical making that relationship. The second thing that is really important is to know the audience that you're talking to. Do not assume that they have any interest at all in science. Most of them don't. I mean, it's very difficult for us to understand up at the front of the room why anybody in the world would not be interested in the problems that we're interested in. I cannot understand why anybody would not dedicate their entire life to tracing this molecule methane around in the atmosphere. I mean, what is more interesting than doing that? But unfortunately, there are people in the world that don't want to do that, so you have to be able to know the audience that you're talking to get them to really understand the central issues. You do not want to dumb the issue down, but what you've got to be able to do is to recognize what you're starting with. I have a little story. I was on Ontario Commission that was trying to decide what they were going to do with decommissioning their fossil fuel energy production. This was a group of MPs. There were 20 MPs on this commission. You go into this room, you sit in this little chair with this little table in front of you. I think they deliberately designed it to try and intimidate you, and everybody's in a horseshoe around you. There's an amazing amount of kibitzing going back and forth because it's an all-party commission, and so they're all fighting their politics while you're discussing these types of things. And then I did my presentation, and all I did was calculate for them, knowing the emissions that came out of the fossil fuel generating systems, how much, if they shut those down, they would reduce, Ontario's emissions would reduce. And what I did was I took the reduction, put it over their annual emissions, and calculated out the ratio, and then multiplied it by 100 that said they would get a 7% reduction in their greenhouse gas emissions. The member of parliament from Muskoka put up her hands and went, hold on a minute, Professor Roulet. I didn't take advanced calculus at university. I'm only an accountant, so I don't understand how you did these calculations. Well, there is a hilarity to this in a way, because immediately the NDP person on the table, who used to be the finance minister for the NDP, really sharp guy, jumped on this immediately and said, hold on a minute. You're an accountant. You don't know how to do a ratio, and you're going to do my taxes? And so there's this kibitzing that goes on. But I then spent the next 15 minutes explaining to them how to calculate a ratio and get it into a percent reduction. These are 20 decision makers that are actually working on going to vote on policy in front of the legislature in Ontario. So don't underestimate or overestimate your audience that you're dealing with. You've got to be able to get it into language that they think about. The third thing is know why you're there and stick to your script, because when you're in one of these environments, you can get sidetracked into traps to say something that will be used against you to completely destroy the credibility of everything else that you said, even if it was very useful. So you get a 99.9% of your testimony was bang on, 0.1 of your testimony had a little flaw in it, and they'll trap you. And the trap that they tried to get me in the same commission was I kept going back and forth and saying there will be a 7% reduction. So then they would say to me, oh, so that means that you're in favor of nuclear power. I said, no, I didn't say that. What I said is that if you decommission your coal-fired generating systems, you will reduce greenhouse gas emissions 7%. Well, yes, for us to do that, we have to make up the power from somewhere else. So therefore, you're in favor of nuclear power. I said, no, I'm not a specialist on nuclear power. I do not know the benefits and the costs of environmental costs related to nuclear power other than what I took as an undergraduate and what I read in the newspaper. It's not my area of expertise. This went back and forth for about 10 minutes. Finally, in the end, I said, hold on a minute. Are you not elected by the people of Ontario? And there was this gasp that went kind of across the 20 of them. There was dead silence. And I said, I've put the information from a scientific expertise in front of you about greenhouse gases. Why don't you call somebody, knowing full well that the person that was right behind me actually was from the Nuclear Commission, right behind me. Why don't you ask an expert in that field the questions that you want about nuclear power, and then you as politicians that have been elected by the citizens to make decisions, make the decisions on the information that you've been given. And this gets back to Pelkey's book, because this is exactly what he argues is an honest broker in science, is one that puts all the cards on the table and to the best of their ability and as objectively as they can, lays out the pros and cons from the scientific perspective of each one of those types of decisions that would be made. In this case, we have to go to other people to do it because the range of expertise. The fourth thing is that, and David intimated towards this, and maybe he was a little shy in saying it directly, though I've never known David to be shy about anything, but in Canada, we have what I would say at the present time, a toxic science environment. And it actually starts right at the federal level. In the middle of the last assessment four, the current federal government decided that government scientists could not communicate their science. It had to be communicated by communication officers. It had to be filtered. I think it's a tragedy in Canada that people didn't come to arms over this issue. It was a tiny article that was buried in the Victoria newspaper is, Margaret Munro. She tried to champion this argument three times in newspapers. It got in a tiny column in the National Post. where she talked about the seminars that the scientists I know in Environment Canada actually had to go to, which was basically to educate them on how they were able to communicate or not communicate their science when they were asked questions about it. This is a policy that's in place in Canada now. So what happens now is that if a scientist is asked a particular question, they have to submit that question to their communication officers. The communication officer goes away and decides what the ministry or department's answer will be to that question. These are not scientists that are answering these questions. These are communications officers. And this actually tinges a little bit, gets very close to another book that I recommend you read by Mark Bowen, which is called Censoring Science, which is the story about Jim Hansen at NASA GIS, which is an incredible story. Thank God universities exist, and he used his departmental appointment, adjunct appointment at Columbia University to be able to fight this. So what he did is every time he stood up and spoke about climate, he said, I am an adjunct professor at Columbia University. I am not speaking in my official capacity as a scientist at NASA. I am speaking as an adjunct professor at Columbia University. And then what he did is he completely lambasted the government policy on climate change in the United States. And he did this every time, and then to the point that he actually had to get solicitors to be able to and they challenged the administration and NASA over using one of the amendments to the Constitution, the freedom of speech, to be able to do this, and he won. And it's a terrific book to read about. We don't have the same mechanisms in Canada, and our scientists are being quietly muzzled on this. So there is an obligation for us that are not in the government that know about this information to participate even more in the scientific debates because it's not being done at the science level. One of the last things I want to talk a little bit about is the anticipation of what policy science will be relevant to policy. The problem you're dealing when you deal with a policy field is that the science that they needed 2 years ago. No one knew what the questions were at that point in time. And when they asked me what we need to do about, for example, peatlands in northern Ontario, these types of things, what I say is I don't have enough information to answer that question, and I can give you a 10-year research program that might get us near the point to be able to address that question. This anticipation in policy or making science policy relevant is one that we need to get more and more engaged in as scientists. Because the thing is that we have to recognize that politics is on a four-year or less cycle. That's really how relevant it is. There's a very famous story of Stephen Schneider, who died recently, very famous climate scientist. Senate hearings in 1988, stood up, was showing the various different graphs of the waves of climate. There's, 10,000-year cycles, 6,000-year cycles, 20-year cycles. There's the 200-year rise. And some senator from western United States said, son, there's only three cycles on this hill that matter, 2, 4, and 6 years. Unless you can get it in that context, it's not going to have any traction on this hill. In Canada, we have to anticipate what are the critical questions that we're going to need to address, because if we don't, the problem is it's just-in-time science, and just-in-time science does not inform policy very well at all. The last two things have to do with science as a social dimension. We have to think very much of the institutional or social setting that our science is being done in, and this hit me right over the head. We were arguing in the second assessment report, there was 20 of us sitting around a round table like this, arguing over I wrote the section on methane. We're sitting there arguing over, rice patties, do they emit 50 teragrams of methane or do they emit 60 teragrams of methane and stuff. The fellow that was sitting right beside me was a scientific representative from Maldives. Finally, after 2 days of arguments, he stood up and he said, you guys disgust me. I kind of looked at him and said, you're arguing over plus or minus 50 teragrams while my country's going underwater. And that really puts it in the context. Here we're sitting, it was an intellectual debate that we were essentially having at the table and the immediacy of these things. So not all people come from the very same social context that you come from when you're involved in these types of things. So we've got to be very sensitive about these things and very aware of where we're coming from. The last thing is that I want to talk about is all environmental science, if it is important and useful, is political, and it is a contested issue. And you need to deal with this, and you need to be able to cope with this if you're going to work in these particular fields. If anybody tells you that the IPCC has no political involvement at all, they're lying. There's absolutely no case about this. And the very good example of this is the AR4 that we published in 2007. I was not there, because I was one author below the level, but the two senior authors on our chapter, you go in this room in Paris, there's 200 scientists sitting out there that are the lead authors in the front of this. The people that do the summary, the technical summary, or the policy summary that you get, which is the thing that everybody reads, they're not scientists. There are a few scientists that are on that panel that read it, but it's actually a political document. It is all the ministers of environment that sit there that actually fine-tune this document. For 2.5 days in Paris, the argument was over the word unequivocal or very likely or highly likely. 4-5 words in the English language. 2.5 days discussion over that. And what ended up happening was the scientists vetoed every single time the politicians wanted to soften the term, the scientists vetoed. The scientists have no say other than they have these little pom-pom things that have one side of it that says yes, the other side says no. And so they would say, this is the consensus wording we are recommending. Probable. No. Vetoed. Another 4 hours of discussion. The main blog on this was China. China did not want any terms in there that actually attributed highly likely or more greenhouse gas emissions to climate change to greenhouse gas emissions in that political environment. The only reason why the AR report came out in the end is that all 200 scientists walked on Wednesday night. They stood up and said, we've voted this, we have vetoed this. 42 times they vetoed it. And they finally said, this is a waste of time, and they walked out. And it was only through political brokermanship overnight that they got them back to the table, and the Chinese surrendered in the terms. I think it was very likely went in. I can't remember actually what the term was in the end that went in. But all these things are highly politically charged environments. There are always underlying currents behind that. David and I sat on a science advisory panel. He was chair of that science advisory panel. Very, very good ideas about, and in fact, if you read it on paper, it is a stellar document that happened with the Ontario Far North Act in terms of, it's the only piece of legislation I know in the Western world that actually has the words in there of the objective is to conserve and preserve ecological function in an actual piece of legislation that recognizes that in the first place. Whether it goes anywhere is going to be very, very interesting to see, because the political dimensions of plunking that type of legislation down into the context of even who has sovereignty over that area in Northern Ontario is a totally different ballgame. So these things are all politically loaded.